You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Well, you know where my druthers be. I'd rather troll on anywhere. And that's why we love getting together with scientist Mark Fritchett, because he is an offshore guy. He's a pelagic guy like me. He's frequent with the entire fishery, of course. But we're going to talk today about how it is outside. And there are things that have been going on internationally. There are things that are coming up here locally. And there's just a whole bunch of stuff to talk about. But I thought we'd start with Mark, because as you know, next week is the Spinners Ahi Fever Shootout, the Spinners Ahi Shootout tournament. And it is the one that concentrates on the yellow guy. And since that's right up Mark Fitch's wheelhouse, we're going to begin talking about Ahi. And up to a few years ago, and I know, Mark, before you got here, or maybe you did or maybe you didn't, we didn't really realize that we had a local Ahi, you know, population. We knew that we did, but we didn't realize how big it might be. And is that sort of part of the stuff that you walked into when you first got here, trying to identify how big the yellowfin tuna colony is in the Hawaiian Islands?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of been an ongoing question that folks have been trying to address for many years. You know, David Tano did a lot of tagging work, and we did some microchemistry work that shows that there are discernible groups of ahi, of yellowfin, that are sort of native to Hawaii and also the Line Islands. Mm-hmm. We also have tagging data show that not only do we probably have our own local stock, but we're also at a juncture of the West and the East, and so we have migratory fish that pass through as well.
Yeah, when I was a kid, and I think almost everybody can relate to this, back in the day, everybody used to think that ahi season was because this is when they're passing by Hawaii. So in the areas where you can fish, it was the Kona Coast. It was certainly the Waianae Coast, which we're talking about. I think the compass heading 270, go 270, there's always ahi there. It got to a point where, and then they would say, well, the bite's gone, they've moved on. But now, doesn't science sort of support what you just said, that it might be a combination of both, and from what we understand, part of our indigenous homeboys might go somewhere else.
That's true. They may go somewhere else. They may be moving island to island. I mean, as we say, you know, I had a professor in undergrad that said, you know, animals think about three things. That's food, sex, and death.
Yeah.
And so they're going to move when it's spawning time, yeah, when it's time for them to you know, to do their deeds, and then also to find food. Yeah. And so, like you said, the west side of the Big Island, and then Oahu, you get a lot of upwelling, a lot of eddies, which are bring a lot of food. So fishing's good. And you know, I also think people from a larger perspective, and it's funny you bring the local stock, and we talked about maybe we have some expatriates here, but the importance of our local small boat fisheries to understanding the stock has been kind of not really been utilized as much as we should. And we've been talking about utilizing some of the data that has been generated from dealer reports as well as catch reports from some of the small boat tuna folks out here, Palo Ahi, Kashibi, and then even some of the troll folks, not only for tuna but also for billfish, because these are the only directed fisheries for billfish and for shibi tuna.
You know, interesting you say that, because I know a lot of the folks like shibi because they're easy to handle. Almost you can put some of them in a pan. But the problem is that if that's a stock that you need to breed, that sometimes practicing release on these little fish is probably a good idea, but not likely to happen, because most of the people that catch them inside, that's what they want. They don't care how big the fish is. They just want to catch fish.
Yeah, and all, but you also is to take in the context, we do get a lot of rat tuna that people do catch, and those are interesting. Well, from a scientific perspective, as we discussed in prior shows, I've been trying to get some tissue samples from those fish. But the interesting thing about, you know, one thing to consider is that the total mortality that the ahi, both big eye and yellowfin ahi, are seeing from the troll fisher, from the hand fishery here in Hawaii, is almost insignificant and minuscule compared to the juvenile mortality of ahi tuna from the purse seine fisheries, which are in the southern latitudes, just about, you know, 300, 600 miles
where,
south of us.
Where you're going to catch all the babies. I mean, virtually, yeah, when you get to that kind of school, you catch them.
Right, yeah. And they're targeting skipjack, so there's an unintentional mortality. And if you look at the last stock assessment, the juvenile mortality, fishing mortality rate, right? Mm-hmm. So you know that total, like your natural mortality of a small fish is obviously going to be larger than that of an older fish.
Yeah, food
but,
chain.
But when you look at fishing mortality, from the stock assessments, shown that the fishing mortality rates of juveniles are much higher than the adults, which shows that there's an imbalance and the rate of exploitation. So, but all that mortality, none of that juvenile mortality is really attributed to the local, you know, the amount of catch that comes out of the local ahi, handline and troll fisheries is tiny compared to longline and purse seine.
Yeah, and I'm glad Mark brought up longline. I mean, a handline, because in parts of the Pacific they don't even own reels. I mean, they catch fish with handlines,
right?
And I do know that almost here, almost everybody tells you that their handlines are their most productive lures. I mean, they catch fish more on their handlines than they do on their big 130 Penn Senators or 130 Tiagras, and particularly the smaller fish. But every now and again, you have a handline that's maybe rubber banded back on your stern cleat that's out 30, 40 feet behind you, and a 300-pound fish will hit it.
Yeah.
Then you have a problem.
Yeah.
You know, because it's going to be pretty hard to fly that thing into the boat. But isn't it true that you know a lot about the fisheries in other parts of the Pacific where that's the method of catch? And it's actually part of economics. I mean, you know, the gear that we use is expensive, and those people don't have that kind of money.
Yeah, but also time is money too.
Sure.
And so a lot of parts of the world, like in the Philippines and Micronesia, and in Indonesia, they're using what's called ring nets or surround nets, which are sort of like miniature seines to catch skipjack and little big eye, because that's it's a more efficient means. It's not expensive to operate, and you know, boat time is money too. So to get out there on a boat.
And by the way, you got no idea how expensive fuel is in some of those places.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we think it's bad here. Whoa. You know, in some other places, it's a lot worse. But interestingly enough, I want to return to that since we're talking about Ahi and the Spinners Cafe tournament next week. That this is the revered fish that we have. You know, and you and I were talking off the air before we started recording today about Tombo, about albacore. Local people don't prefer albacore, but the further back on the mainland you get, that's like the steak, you know? So,
yeah.
So isn't it sort of ironic? And what have your studies shown you, or what does science sort of suggest about the indigenous albacore stock in Hawaii?
Okay, that's an interesting subject. In fact, when I was in San Diego a couple weeks ago, there's a scientist over in San Diego by the name of Steve Tio, and Steve works on albacore fisheries in the Pacific. So we have a northern Pacific albacore stock that extends from Washington State, and there's a large, I wouldn't say large, but there is a considerable fishery in Canada between with the Canadians and Washington, Oregon State, and Northern California, troll fishery. And those fish are caught when they're younger there, and they migrate to Japan. So you'd get this northern stock. And so oftentimes it's thought when they traverse the Pacific, they're following the cooler water and then going north of Hawaii. So we don't really get a whole lot of albacore. But historically in the past, you know, folks were catching large tumbo, large and small.
Yeah, and by the way, these, when we're talking about them here in Hawaii, I can recall 30, 40 to 70 pounds, pretty good sized fish. But one thing that's really fascinating, and I wish that our listeners could live through this experience that I did in the Pacific Northwest. It was an Oregon boat that is actually a albacore boat that moved to Hawaii later and became a longline boat.
Huh.
But the albacore gear and the way they fished, they had these big widespread outriggers, and they had six or eight lines off each one, you know, and going to either a basket of ahu or a line or a reel. And they would just be trolling for these albacore and not even slow the boat down. When a fish breaks off, they just kept going at the same speed, brought in the fish. And they just, in other words, it was a very efficient way to fish as long as they weren't too big.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? When these fish are, what, 10, 12 pounds, these fish that they're catching that way?
Yeah, and they get anything. I mean, so the size range, so that's like a juvenile, I think, is like a 20-pounder. I think that's what they're getting. And from the troll fisheries in Oregon, mm-hmm. Washington State, about 20 pounders. And also in Japan, they also mm-hmm. have a lot of juveniles. Yeah. So this is funny, is there's troll fisheries that target albacore.
Yeah.
You know, their catch rates are oftentimes used as a index for recruitment because they're catching a very narrow band or very narrow bandwidth or range of small sizes. But they do catch some pretty large ones.
Yeah. And it's kind of fascinating when you think about it because you don't look at that in Hawaii. It's never considered a big schooling, huge, big stock like a pile of aku would be or a pile of shibi would be.
But they're pretty prolific. Mm-hmm. I mean, so just to give you kind of an overview of the albacore fisheries, we have two stocks in the Pacific. We have a southern stock, which America Samoa, which mm-hmm. is under council, under our auspices for management. They have a longline fishery for albacore, mm-hmm. and they're down in the south where it's a little bit cooler, down some near the
edge. Hence the population, because the albacore prefer cooler
water. Yeah. And then up here in the north, we don't really have too much of a huge fishery for them because of those cold water fronts that thermal structure is not as close to Hawaii as maybe as it once was in the past. And also, there's not as much fishing in the northwest Hawaiian Islands. Mm-hmm. There's not around that area from U.S. boats or further north. But there is a large fishery for albacore, and the rate of exploitation for albacore, the amount of exploitation the stock has been able to withstand is pretty remarkable. It's a very productive stock, both in the south and the north. And the number one right now, I would say, fishing country for albacore is China.
Is that right?
And
Wow.
And I think China put in, I was looking at the effort amount of hooks they put in the east and the northeast Pacific. The amount of effort they put in was about as much as Japan, Korea, Taiwan, and U.S. combined.
You know, that's fascinating. And I tell you what I think is also interesting. It's a two-parter. One is, what does it suggest is the population of albacore in the Monument area? I mean, because you almost, maybe it's too warm for them in certain parts of Monument, I don't know. But the other one is that, you know, here in Hawaii, we know that local people do not prefer albacore over other species. It's the least desirable because it's less oily and less, fatty than skipjack. Number one is aku. Because it's blood, black meat, but they love it.
Yeah, I like it too.
But it doesn't travel very well.
Yeah.
So you got to catch it and eat it. Albacore, from what we understand, that can take almost like swordfish. It holds pretty well for a long time.
Yeah, and for some people, and for a lot of folks that want to, I would say, catch in mass a species, albacore would be a candidate species because mm-hmm. it's a very prolific spawner. And you know, the amount of productivity and the amount of egg production that these fish have is remarkable. I think, say, albacore and skipjack are very productive species. One of the issues that we don't necessarily understand, and I think I talked to you all off the air, was with these larger albacore, there's reason to believe that most of those fish are males.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
you got to listen to this. That's why Mark's a scientist, but he gets to do some kind of cool stuff. And I never really thought, until you explained it to me, why that could even be. And you tell me it's because females have a pretty tough time.
Yeah, and it's the same with some of the yellowfin and skipjack, in which, you know, there was evidence in the East Pacific to show that natural mortality rates of female fish. When I say natural mortality, that is the sort of the rate of which they naturally die mm-hmm. due to natural causes. And so oftentimes when species, you know, like for example, like salmon, right, they go and they essentially spawn and die.
Yeah.
But a lot of species, they don't necessarily adopt that life history strategy, but their rate of death is much higher once they reach a spawning age. And so female skipjack, a yellowfin tuna in some parts of the world, and albacore, you know, there's reason to believe that these fish, once they reach their maturation and spawning, they're exerting so much of their needs, of their biological needs, into egg production and spawning that they pretty much just exhaust themselves and die.
You know, here's something really interesting. When Mark was mentioning just a minute ago, salmon. You know, you see these pictures and these movies, which are incredible, about how these salmon go to their birthplace. They go upstream to breed. They get so beat up getting up there to lay their eggs. Right after they lay their eggs, when you go downstream, on both sides of these streams, no matter where you go, in the Northwest, in Oregon, in certainly in Washington, in Canada, you see just thousands and thousands of fish dead on the sides of the, on the streams. And you think, shouldn't somebody be scooping that stuff up and eating? Well, it is to get it eaten. There's carrion, there's bears, there's all that stuff that eat that stuff. But really, they swim upstream. They're signing their death warrant.
Yeah, and with the albacore and some of these tuna species, I know, like in the eastern Pacific, they're using the example of yellowfin tuna. Like, you know, they're dying at rates of three. The females are dying at rates of 3.5 times that males are after they reach maturity. And so you get these sex ratio skews at larger size. But in the case of these tunas, I mean, when I say, you know, natural mortality rate is higher, they're not just, you know, just having a heart attack and dying. Yeah, a lot of it's because of their expenditures and they're maybe not as efficient swimmers. They may be easy prey.
Well, they're preyed upon. Sure, yeah. Absolutely.
Or they're more catchable. Yeah. I mean, there's lots of other issues, confounding issues at play, but what that suggests is that the stock is extremely productive and that at the larger size ranges that you have all males. So from a fishery standpoint as well, you might as well
catch them.
Sort of the rationale that some folks have. Now, with the Chinese expansion in the South Pacific, albacore and America Samoa, you know, they're an island. Community like we are here in Hawaii, and so their fisheries don't have the range as some of these really, really large longliners that the Chinese have.
Sure.
So what's happening is right now, in 2017, just to put this in numbers, I think 92,000 metric tons of albacore was removed from the ocean.
Ooh, that's
and,
a lot of fish.
And yeah. China yeah. took 45,000 of those metric tons. Yeah. And so poor America Samoa only had roughly not even 2,000 metric tons. And so there's catch rates are declining in some of these island countries because there is, you know, this fear, or not fear, I wouldn't say fear, that's not even a really good word. It's probably the reality that access to a healthy stock is sort of being stonewalled by fisheries that are keeping access to these. So when these albacore are making runs and migrations, it's quite possible that these high seas longline fleets are actually impeding the access of albacore to these island countries.
Yeah, it makes sense. You know,
and there's been that's been a lamentation in the Northwest United States with albacore. Some of my colleagues up there have said, well, we need to make sure that this fishing capacity from China does not continue to increase because it's essentially going to put these guys out of business.
Yeah. And listen, every time you talk about that, what happens economically is just unbelievable. I mean, it can be so decimating so quickly. Interestingly enough, and I know that we don't really appreciate it in the main islands. Most of our listeners, you know, we're more looking for where do we catch the fish and where do we eat it and where can we buy it, but when you talk about some of the things that are going on in your world, and that is the allocation of quotas and all of this kind of stuff, if you have a quota that you can't meet because the fish aren't coming into your fishery like they used to, if anything, it's going to reduce your quota because they're going to say, well, the stock is damaged there, so we have to reduce the quotas, otherwise it'll disappear.
Yeah, and especially for some, and it puts some of these island nations and island communities and territories, when they go to to the commission at the end of the year, it puts them in a tough spot because oftentimes, you know, for the case of Tonga, America Samoa, Cook Islands, for albacore, doesn't necessarily mean that stock is in bad shape. It means their catch rates are going bad. And so, you know, and so the argument on the other side of the table was, well, the stock is healthy, so why should we continue to come up with these provisions that reduce catch? That's what China or Taiwan or some of these countries may say. And so it really puts when you have a healthy stock and your catch rates are low, it's an unfair situation to be in. And so, but in the case for being a big eye tuna here in Hawaii, we have a healthy stock. We have a fishery that is recently, in the last few months, we've actually been seeing high catch rates of big eye down at Pier 38.
Yeah, it's been very encouraging, by the way.
Yeah, and the Hawaii fishery is going to reach its quota by September 15. Originally, it was almost two months later. So that to show in the last 30, 40 days that catch rates have been very high here in Hawaii for big eye tuna. And so that shows, and so the quota, that date that we're expecting to hit the quota is actually creeping up closer and closer. So,
but unfortunately, as we get closer to the holidays, the demand goes skyrocketing. The price goes crazy.
It does. And so there's pros and cons to these high catch rates. But also, we have a territorial agreement with America, Samoa, Guam, and CNMI. And in the next 2 weeks, we're going to be discussing this at the council meeting, in which we can actually have, so they have catch limits for the three territories, and they can allocate 1,000 metric tons
to us.
Yeah, here in Hawaii.
And I knew this is where Mark was going, gang. I want you to understand, Mark Fitchett is the scientific end of what happens at the council. So scientists like him are the ones that are charged with the responsibility of data gathering, analysis, and then recommendations. And we don't relate to that, but our demand, we already know the demand is going to be through the roof every holiday season as it is. And everybody always gets worried about stock. The relationship that we have by taking others' quotas, by doing deals, is what guarantees there to be not just fish on the plate, but reasonably priced fish on the plate at that time of the year.
Yeah.
It's going to get expensive anyway, but it could be a lot higher.
The big thing is local product. So do you want that tailpipe tuna or that product coming from somewhere else? Yeah. And the thing is, here in Hawaii, we have local fresh product that come from Apalahi, Ikashibi, longline fisheries, troll fisheries here. That's unique. We have fresh Hawaiian tuna. And so that's something that needs to be maintained in the market. And, you know, one also thing to look at when we talk about allocation is compliance and compliance monitoring. And I've said this many times before in past shows, Hawaii has 100% observer coverage in its swordfish fishery and 25% in its deep set longline fishery for that targets tuna. Every other country in the Western Central Pacific Ocean fails on most years to meet a 5% coverage rate of observers.
Amazing, huh?
United States.
Yeah, it's so, in many respects, it is extremely unfair that
it is extremely unfair, and we are beholden to higher restrictions. But at the same time, that needs to be used to build consumer confidence that we are fishing sustainably. And also another thing to consider is transshipment of products. So what transshipment is the movement of product from one vessel to another at sea. United States has zero transshipment of its products, particularly with big eye tuna.
But it is none. So common in the others.
And that's
so
where a common. Lot of shady stuff happens. Yeah. And so compliance monitoring, compliance, observer coverage, data reporting, the United States is the gold standard, and Hawaii fishery is the gold standard of the Pacific.
You know, one of the things that comes up, and it's semi-related to this. I want to go back to the albacore and the big eye and the ahi again. I mean, the yellowfin again. And that is that here in Hawaii, we already know that our market doesn't appreciate albacore because of the way we eat fish. I mean, a lot of us are eating raw fish or blackened fish or poke bowl fish or something. And albacore traditionally doesn't have the distinctive flavor or texture or even look of ahi. It's white.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like a tuna until you open it up. But that means that other places actually prefer that. So in many places, back east, for instance, albacore would get you more money than ahi.
In some cases, and I think in particularly in the Northwest, and that's in the Northwest United States. I mean, but when you look in some parts of the world, albacore is going to be more preferred because it keeps well.
Yeah,
it
travels very well.
And like with skipjack, I mean, they essentially have to process skipjack on the ship.
Yeah.
And I prefer skipjack aku, and because it's you eat it fresh within the first day.
Yeah.
And so we have a luxury also here in Hawaii that we have a resource that is close to where we live and to where we go to the market.
How have methods of transporting skipjack improved? From what I understand, the big skipjack purse seiners, they're freezing that fish the minute they catch it.
Yeah. You
know, so they have the capacity at sea to do that.
Yeah, and they put them in this. It's crazy. I'm actually looking forward to going. I'm gonna be able in October to go and get on and at least go on one of these boats and see for myself.
Right when you get back, we want to do a show.
All right.
Yeah, we want people to understand what it was like, what expectations you had, and what actually happened. Right.
Yeah. And another cool thing, you know, these ships that are able to process fish. One of our SSC members who works on the Halibut Commission, Steve Martell, was talking down these boats that catch halibut and hake and some of these ground fish in the Northwest United States.
Bottom fish to you, ground fish.
Yeah. They're using these like crazy shoots. They put the fish in and then they cut the fish using water jets.
Jeez,
and it's crazy and it's precise, and they're able to put this fish into this shoot. And it is, deceased and then cut and then processed, frozen, packaged, all
done.
Within. Yeah. And they can process something like tens of thousands of pounds a day. Yeah. I mean, on boat. It is incredible.
In one respect, you have to appreciate the science that went into doing that. And what, whether we like to admit this or not, most of us in this day and age are no longer hunters and gatherers.
No.
And we have population bases and huge populations in places where there is no fresh fish.
Yeah.
But there's a demand for it. This is a very efficient way of catching and processing that ship so it can make it to that destination.
Yeah, and there's
and also, be good.
And be good. Yeah. There's also some concern that, and there's a legitimate concern, and there should be some concern that, increasing technology is increasing the chance of extirpating local fisheries and essentially it's like too big for its own good, too efficient for its own good. And that's why I think here in Hawaii, and I've been the pleasure of talking to some of our local Ikashibi, Palawahi, troll fishers here and Big Island as well as here, is we have a unique fishery which, sells a unique product, fresh product. Shibi, ahi, aku, and it's caught, with essentially zero bycatch, caught sustainably, caught by folks who, live on the water, essentially. Yeah. And I think that's something that we need to be embracing those fisheries more. And I think there's a lot of listeners in Waianae and then in Kona and elsewhere who would agree with me.
Yeah, and by the way,
we need to embrace these fisheries.
Absolutely. And maybe you could also expand on this a little bit. In Hawaii, I think, just because of the ethnicity and everything else, the bycatch is nowhere near as big as an issue as it is in other places. Because you may hear, let's say you catch a lot of a species in your overnight, in your nets, that you don't want. Somebody does.
Yeah.
So you know somebody that does. I have this family that they want the manini, or they want the koli, or they want the palani. I just want this. I want the mempachi. They can have all the dark stuff. There are other places where this is happening in wholesale quantities where that bycatch is just being dumped.
Yeah.
Nobody's eating it. I mean, it's going to the bottom of the sea and disintegrating. It's not a good use of fish.
Yeah, and I agree, and I'm glad you brought that up. And when I was in Kona, and I've spent some time there, and it was kind of disheartening to hear some of the negativity that a lot of folks have been sort of, and I guess microaggressions people have been giving some of the fishermen there, because they see, they hear about the waste and this sort of capricious, over exploitation of resources. They see that on TV and on Instagram and on Facebook, and then they see these boats, parked there that are catching tuna and a lot of tuna, but they don't understand the resource dynamics. They don't understand that the amount of bycatch is zero in a lot of these fisheries. And there's a lot of misinformation. And I think it's unfortunate. And there is some parts of the world, and even in the United States, when you start looking at the shrimp fishery in the Gulf of Mexico and some of these fisheries where you have wanton waste, right? Yeah, you just have wholesale over-exploitation of the target species and also of bycatch species. Well, we don't have that in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Folks, we
figure out a way to eat everything.
But also the fisheries are tried and true, and they know how to target their species without catching things that they don't want.
Yeah, it's another good point. By the way, and I rib Mark because different people call, well, we call it bottom fishing. It's ground fishing.
Yeah.
And there are guys in our ground fishery, in our bottom fishery, they not only know what species to go where they are, but they know how to differentiate in a given fishing spot between the fishes that they want and the ones that they don't want.
And the bite, they can tell the way it's hitting a rod.
Yeah.
These are tried and true fisheries. They don't understand is like they fishermen here want to target. They know how to target fish without catching things that they don't want, because waste is waste of money. And and that's, but also, you know, you see all these fishing nets washed up on shore. You see a lot of this, unfortunate waste and that comes with fisheries. And people don't understand is that every fishery is completely different.
Yeah.
And what and the folks that they see lined up in the docks who are leaving to go fish for ahi are not the ones who are the ones who deserved a lot of this ire. And I think we need to be very careful to differentiate the good players and the bad players.
Yeah, amen. And you know what, gang? One of the things that I want to do, Dr. Fitchett, Mark, will be back with us next week. And we got some other stuff. But I thought we could wind up today going back to where we were when we started. And that is, there's something magic about the summertime. We just talked about the holiday time and when the quotas get and we have to go out and make deals to get our IE and our big eye in. But right now is the fun time for tuna, because there's tuna everywhere. And it looks like being a pretty good year. And you are actually amazed to know how many boats show up in these tournaments.
Yeah.
This is a big deal. It's bragging rights for the biggest fish, of course. But, of course, everybody gets eaten. And there is, like you say, there's no bycatch in these fishing tournaments. None. You know, they just go out and they catch what they want to catch. And if they start catching, say, mahi mahi, and they're in a trolling tournament, they don't want mahi mahi. They want to catch an ahi or a marlin. However, if there's plenty of mahi mahi, some of the skippers say, hey, wait a minute. It's worth it for us to go catch these fish.
Yeah.
Instead of worrying about catching the trophy fish for the tournament, because we can go sell all this mahi mahi this afternoon.
That's true.
Isn't that amazingly different in some places you've been where you can't recreationally sell your fish?
No, I mean, you can't, and then there's not a market for it.
Yeah.
And you know, it's also, you know, we're unique here in Hawaii that fish is a cultural part of the cuisine, and it's a culture. It's also fishing and hunting. It's a part of living off the land, living off the sea, living off the resources within our arm's reach.
What is your research show, or what are some of the other things that you might have picked up about ahi? A lot of times, you know, at this time of the year, particularly, ahi seem to be close in. You know, you go out to the fads, out to the buoys, out to the 1,000 fathom ledge. Some boats go 30, 40 miles out. When they're out there, is that still part of our island school?
Yeah, and it is. I mean, I would say, okay, so that's actually a good question, right? So what do you consider, how do you differentiate, are your expatriate fish, the ones that are coming in from California or coming in from Marshall Islands or wherever, are they also commingling inshore or close to shore? We don't really know. What we do know is when we were taking some tissue samples from big eye rat ahi, and I've had some local fishermen help me get the samples, is fish that are caught within 120 miles from shore generally have fidelity towards the main Hawaiian islands, right?
So
that's one of the assumptions that have been made, but that's actually a good question that we need to start looking at with our adult fish and tagging, doing more tagging work. Now, do these expat fish come in closer to shore, or are they only within range of the longline fleet?
Yeah, interestingly enough, you say that. And then one of the things that I kind of like is whenever you're doing stock assessments or whatever, or where you're looking, fish don't know what grid they're in.
No.
They're following a food chain. They're following something. So if yesterday you surveyed an area and there was a huge big pile of ahi, and they're not there today, they're pretty close.
Yeah.
But you know, in other words, who is responsible at what geographic point? How many miles out should the state be concerned? And then where does the council take over? 200 miles. That 200 miles, that's a lot of space.
Well,
and then there's also 20.
Yeah, well, we're more concerned. Well, you know, due to the movement of the fishery, the council, we're concerned, the entire you know, from pretty much just a mile or two offshore to 200 miles, but also internationally.
Yeah.
So we internationally manage these fisheries as well. So we're, but I think for, I guess the, I guess when we say what is the provision of ahi, you know, it is a good question that we need to look into. Are all those same fish that are being caught and targeted by the ikashibi, palawahi, troll boats, also the same fish being targeted by the longline?
Yeah.
We don't know that. And so we need more research, genetic work and tagging work. And we're working with some of our partners to figure that out.
Yeah, and there you go. That's going to be a good place for us to leave it this time. Mark Fincher will be back next time. One of the things we're going to talk about, a couple of weeks ago, last week we talked to Marlo Saboteur. And we talked about corner crab, and we talked about some of the neat things that have gone on. Turns out that Mark Fincher was a scientist that was sort of really involved in that stock assessment.
Yep.
And we'll talk about that next time, too. In the meantime, if you've got something that you'd like to hear on the program, let me know. Drop me an email, themikebuckshow@gmail.com, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. So for Mark Fincher and me, and, of course, everybody at the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, thanks for listening to Go Fish. We'll see you next time. Aloha.